My name is Sarah, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Sarah.
So West Ghent is my home group in Norfolk, and my sobriety date is October 27th, 1989, which means I was 16. And gosh, I was thinking today, as one does before one speaks, kind of what it was like. And you know, I definitely knew I had a problem with alcohol when I got here. I was blacking out. I was having things happen to me that I couldn't really control. I think the worst of it was, is like, I had a certain amount, like I could usually get to drink at, like, you know, when you're an underage alcoholic in North Carolina, like you get like an allotted amount from your supplier. You know, that not being enough after a while, and starting to add some, you know, other substances into the mix, because I couldn't, like, that feeling of not being able to drink enough, and it was terrible. You know, the summer before, I was thinking the summer before I actually got sober, I had quit drinking with a lot of fanfare, told people I was taking a break, and I think it maybe lasted like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and then I was drunk, and I was horribly drunk, and I was like drunk all the time. And I think it may be a year before that, when I was probably 15, I was in a locked psych ward telling my doctors I thought I had a strange relationship with alcohol. So, I mean, I guess, you know, I had spent a lot of time since I got sober, particularly in the early years of my sobriety, like wondering what like thing of my parents I could blame them for being an alcoholic. Like, it's got to be their fault. Something, you know, but truthfully, I think I was just born this way. You know, from my earliest memories, I was angry. I never felt like I fit in. I had a chip on my shoulder. I felt like I had to solve life, and that I didn't have really the answers to do that. But like, that was something I had to do. I had to figure it out. And I was like that since I was the day I was born. And it's funny, the things you'll think about to try to explain, the things I would think about to try to explain why I'm an alcoholic, when the truth is I just am one. And it doesn't, the why of it, you know, doesn't really matter. So I was born, and I always felt like I didn't fit in. I always felt like on the outside, like other kids had it better, their houses were neater, their mothers didn't cry as much as mine, you know, whatever, whatever. And I was always really focused on like the outsides of things, like how they looked, how I looked, how I could like adjust my relative appearance to theirs. And it was very uncomfortable. And when I was in sixth grade, I got drunk for the first time. And it was like a relief. Like, that's kind of the only way I can describe it. It was like immediate relief that like immediately went awry. So like, it's always funny to me, because in a way, like my first drinking experience was sort of like every other drinking experience I had, in that it started out great and like ended up with me throwing up. And I didn't have any answers, and alcohol helped me live like that. You know, I think part of my story is that before I really started drinking, you know, I had that drinking experience in the sixth grade, but I didn't like immediately start to drink alcoholically. I had that experience. It was pretty good. But, you know, I had some negative social repercussions from it, because it was a sleepover and like not everybody got drunk and threw up. So I was a little bit hesitant, And I didn't really drink again until after I had tried to attempt suicide. And back in the 80s in North Carolina, when you did that, you would be sent to an adult psych ward. So I was probably 13 or 14 at that time, and that was a pretty rough scene. And I got out, and I guess, you know, it did have a big deterrent effect. Like, I was determined never to go back. And, you know, I got out of there and I started drinking. Like, it was like really like almost a conscious decision. Like, I will just drink and I will use drugs and I will do those things. For me personally, I did sort of dabble in drugs, but I mainly drank. That's what did it for me. And that's what I devoted all my effort to once I got out of there. You know, I started bringing these jars of orange juice and vodka to school with my lunch. And I remember in my eighth grade year, like failing Algebra 1 and wondering why. And it was like the class I had after lunch. I mean, and that's kind of what we did. We skipped school, we drank during school, we drank after school. Somehow I finagled those like wine boxes into my closet. So I had like boxed wine in my closet. And you know, that continued on for me. And I will say, like, I think there is like a real and true way in which alcohol saved my life. Because I was so uncomfortable living. Like, I had obviously, you don't try to kill yourself when you're like 13 or 14 if you're doing very well. And so alcohol, like truly, I think for a lot of years, it kind of saved me and it carried me. And then, like, it didn't. And then it's like I would get drunk and like awful things would happen to me and I wouldn't really be able to protect myself in any real way because I was like drunk and I couldn't like control my limbs. And my friends, you know, I wasn't hanging out with very nice people. Like once I started drinking, I went pretty immediately from like the ballet crowd to the, you know, miscreant crowd. I mean, you know, whatever passed as miscreants in my small North Carolina town. And, you know, the people you get alcohol and drugs from when you're a minor are not the most upstanding people. So, you know, I was around scary people so I could get my alcohol. And I couldn't protect myself in any way, and it didn't go well for me. I don't know how long I would have gone on like that. I know my last drunk, I was at a party, of course, in the backwoods of North Carolina, in like the back of some like broken down trailer with a big bonfire and all these people, and I was in and out of a blackout. And like super truthfully, I almost got raped. And I got out of that by just pure luck and somebody who wasn't quite as drunk as me. And I didn't make it home that night. And I woke up the next day at a friend's house and her mom was in AA. So I didn't go home that day. I guess I called my parents and was like, I'm not coming home. And they were probably just like, what do I do with this person? But I stayed at my friend's house and her mom like basically 12-stepped me. And I went to my first meeting that night. And I remember somebody handing me my first big book. And I didn't immediately, it wasn't like an immediate sense of homecoming or anything. I was like, oh my God, all these people are so old. But I just, like I just couldn't go on. Like, and I did know I couldn't really live without alcohol. Like, I had established that to myself, like, prior to drinking, that, you know, me on my own in life, it just wasn't going to work. That's why I drank. And so I didn't really know what I was going to do. I will say for, I don't know, a couple months, I would go around and say, like, my name is Sarah and I'm questioning. And so I did that at like a bunch of meetings, and this gal got like a little tired of that. And she told me, like, it was good advice. She was like, if you don't know if you're alcoholic, go find out. And I did. And like, for me, that was worth it, because I think I've heard this before, but it was certainly true for me. Like, I took all the stuff I'd been hearing in AA into that last drinking experience. And it was like kind of very meta, you know, like, oh, you kind of watch yourself and you're like, oh no, it's like what the people talk about. And so I did come back and pick up a white chip, and I did start defining myself as alcoholic. And I haven't had a drink since then. But it is also a true part of my story that I did not resign from, like, thinking I had to figure life out. I did not really think my life was unmanageable. I don't know if it was because of my age or, you know, just I hadn't hit bottom yet. But I definitely didn't think my life was unmanageable. I was gonna manage it. And I was gonna, you know, I feel like, you know the part in the big book where it's like, you swear off, you know, alcohol, you're going to go on a trip, you're not going to go on a trip, you're going to only drink wine, you're going to only drink beer, you're going to do this, you're going to do that, you're going to try to control it, and it never works. And, like, in a real way, I feel like I was like that in AA. Like, I'm going to try this, I'm going to try that. I'm sure not going to read the big book. You know? And I guess part of it is birds of a feather flock together. So, I mean, I kind of found people as crazy as me, and it's not that it wasn't without effect. I mean, I have not drank since 1989, but I have been crazy as shit. And, you know, Dallas and I were just reminiscing. I had one sponsor, she and one of her other sponsees, like, we were gonna rewrite the big book. Like, this book, like, I hadn't even really read. We went through it, actually, and we rewrote it to try to make it, like, less offensive and less patriarchal or whatever. And, you know, I think for the sixth and seventh step, she had me, like, letting cars, like, turn if they needed to turn, or taking grocery carts and putting them back at the front of the store if they were in the parking lot, and like all these silly little things. Like, I don't know what they had to do with much of anything, but I don't want to say I didn't get any help, because I didn't drink, but I had a lot. I was suffering from active alcoholism, and I suffered from that mightily in these rooms for a long time. I think I basically treated AA like a self-help group. Like, I could just kind of pick and choose what I was going to do, and I could manage my alcoholism. Like, I could manage not really the not drinking part, because I had been relieved of that, but the kind of living part. And that worked until my first marriage collapsed, which was to somebody in the program. And, like, I was so angry, because I thought, well, he's in the program and I'm in the program, so it should have worked. And it didn't work. You know, and it was heartbreaking. It was just, like, an absolutely heartbreaking experience. And I was so angry at AA after that. I maybe had a crazy sponsor at that time. I think, as I recall, that sponsor and I agreed I didn't know any amends. You know, but I kind of completely walked away from AA at that point. I decided, I think the first thing I decided was I didn't have to be around anybody I didn't like. And the people I didn't like were the people in AA. So I kind of stopped going to meetings, and I thought, you know what, relief from alcoholism is really like a spiritual solution, and I do a lot of yoga, and I meditate a lot, and that will be it. And, you know, it's just funny how like the kind of like craziness of our disease, and I guess I really do believe that left unchecked, without the way of living described in the book, without having that in my life, my craziness will ultimately take me back to drinking. I'm just lucky it didn't, but it took me to some really dark places. I got myself in a really bad scrape. And it's something that impacted my family, my mother in like the twilight of her life. My father, who was dealing with my dying mother, had to deal with me in this big thing. My child. And that's what got me back to AA, was I couldn't continue. I knew I would drink. And it was hard as hell to come back. And I started coming back to West Ghent. And I was in such a scrape, it was like super hard for me to get out to get to meetings. I didn't have that kind of freedom of movement. But like West Ghent never was like, you don't come here enough. People were just nice to me when I got there. Some woman agreed to work with me for a while, and then she was like, I can't work with you anymore, go talk to Donald. which is like how I ended up with like Donald as my sponsor. Like he was my last hope. Like I was in a mess, and I was like, my life was being torn apart by alcoholism, and like my sponsor fired me, and like I went and I asked Donald for help, and he helped me. He said yes. I don't know what I would have done or what would have happened to me and my kid if he had said no. And what we did was what, like, I had never done in, I don't know, I must have had at least 20 years in the program at that point, going to meetings, doing whatever crazy thing I was doing, and I had never gone through the book with anybody. And he sat with me every week in his kitchen, and we read the book, and we did the things exactly as they are in the book. And I can't tell you how many times prior to this experience that really changed my life deeply. That I would sit around and, oh, those big book thumpers, and what are they talking about, and it's a stupid book anyway, and like, you know, whatever I said. But this book saved my life, and the things we did saved my life, and like the answers are all, they're like not hidden. They're in the book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was like, I would do anything except read that book. But when I read that book, it really has changed my life. Like immediately it helped. You know, I got through that terrible scrape, and that was like many years getting myself out of that. And I didn't really get myself out of it. It was like I was able to walk through that in a spiritual way with Donald's help and like the help of the principles of AA. And it kind of helped me navigate this thing I couldn't have navigated. So there was like immediate relief. You know, I'll say like, I had never done a ninth step, obviously. Like I had, you know, I had that sponsor and she and I had agreed. And like that for me was like the step where I felt like such a connection to God. It was like, bam, I was plugged in. Because it's like when you're making an amends in that moment, you can do nothing but rely on God. Like there is like no, you're there, it's like awkward, you know. Like that was like the most amazing thing to me. And I feel like that's where I really like truly believed, I truly came to believe in the process of my ninth step that God could walk me through anything. And I'll say is like, over the years, it's not like sad things don't happen. Like, you know, my parents are both dead now. That was like the super saddest thing. It's not like I haven't had, you know, difficulties with, you know, whatever. But I have a method of dealing with all of that. You know, I have a way to live that lets me deal with all of that. And I think I always used to think I had to feel good, like all the time. And I was always looking, how am I going to feel good? What's my ease and comfort? You know, when I was drinking, it was clearly alcohol. And when I was not drinking, it was any number of like other crazy behaviors, like kind of compulsive behaviors. And these steps have allowed me to kind of set all that aside. Like I can be sad, I can be fine, I can be bored. You know, that's exactly the kind of thing I could never do, which is like experience life as it comes without doing something crazy because I didn't really like how it was coming or was worried about how it would feel or whatever. And I just don't have to do that today. And that is such a freedom. Like I don't have to sit around and like have imaginary fights in my head because I can write a 10th step about that, right? And that person who bothered me doesn't have to live in my head for 2 weeks. And, you know, I can recognize I feel super sad, like because my dad died, and so I don't have to, you know, go shopping. I can just know I am sad because my dad died. Like, those are the things I could never do. And I am just so grateful. Like, the chance to live without compulsion, alcoholic or otherwise, I think is just the great promise of this program. And it's like a promise that has, it's come to me, it can come to anybody, you know? Because I definitely took the hard road and I did my own thing and it was like anything but the book. And I had nothing but contempt, you know, for big book thumpers. And, you know, the gifts are just, it's amazing. Like I have a really normal life and it's a great life. I have a family. Like my dog peed on the carpet tonight, but like it's not the end of the world, it's just a carpet. You know, I had a long day at work, but here I am. You know, and those kind of things, like that's a miracle for alcoholics. It's a miracle for somebody like me. So anyway, C 29, I got a lot of time left. So not sure where to go from. I feel like I've maybe said my piece, but I guess what I'll just say is that, like, the relationships, I'll say this too. Like, the steps definitely have changed my life, but the other thing that's really helped is just having a home group, going every week, like being mad sometimes at people and still going. Going when I'm tired, like trying to hold myself to that commitment and to have another, for me, like I personally need more than just one group that I go to on a regular basis, because it's just too easy to fall off the map. So I have two groups I go to on a regular basis, and I love them both for different reasons. One of them's my home group, and one of them's not. But they're both great meetings in different ways. But just kind of knowing people longitudinally through the years and having them know you, I think is an amazing thing. And like learning how to be in relationship with people the way you have to when you're in a home group and you need to make a group meeting happen and somebody's got to make the coffee and somebody's got to order literature and maybe you don't want to do any jobs but somebody needs to take the job because you can't have like one person have all the jobs. I mean, that's like an amazing experience. And that feeling of like, I don't, you know, I know I've known Steve, you know, 20 or 30 years, and, but a lot of you, I don't know, but I know we have a lot in common because we're alcoholics, and that's a pretty amazing thing. Like, I can go to a room anywhere in town, and if it's an AA room, like, I will fit in and I will belong. And like, what might be horrifyingly crazy to a non-alcoholic, you guys will just laugh about. And that's a gift I receive and a gift I give by continuing to go to meetings. I think it's one of the big lies that people tell themselves that I told myself. Like, I mean, I'm so tired of hearing so-and-so, and, you know, what do I even get from these meetings anyway? And I've gotten what I need. I've got other things to do. My life's more important. And, like, it's such a short sell, both to the person, to me, in that case, you know, but also to the group. Like, we give each other this, like, community, and it's a pretty beautiful thing. Over the years to just like know people. And I'll say too, like all those people when I first met Steve, I don't know where a lot of them are. I know where some of them are, but I don't know where a lot of them are. I can't honestly remember all the people who cycled out of the rooms. You know, alcoholism is a subtle and deadly foe, and it's like a voice in your head that I feel like the voice never necessarily goes away, but you, I have a reprieve from it. Like, I don't have to follow its dictates. Like, I don't have to follow my first impulse. Today I have the ability to stop and wait and pray and call somebody. You know, and I have those practices because, like, I've been through the Big Book. And there's like actually two pages I read every day, which tell me exactly what to do every day. So I think that's a thing. It gets easy. There's a point I feel like around, I don't know, 10 years, somewhere between maybe 8 and 10 years, where you think, you know, I've gotten what I can get. And it's really not about, like, it's such a short sell if you leave at that point. And really, if you're me, you leave and go into total crazy. And so it's not a good place you're leaving to. And I can't speak for everybody, but I know I am so grateful to still be coming around the rooms. And I'm grateful that the rooms are always forgiving. Like, nobody's ever been like, Sarah, you don't do this, this, and this right. You can't come to our meeting. Nobody's ever said that to me. Nobody's ever said when I was late that I couldn't come in. Nobody's ever said when I left early that I couldn't come back. You know, and I need to be around to give that same acceptance and love to the suffering alcoholic, because I don't know what it took for that person to get to the rooms. I don't know what they're going back to. I know in my case, there were times when I was leaving something terrible and going back to something terrible, and that time in the meeting was like my saving grace. And it was like my window that there could be something better, because I could look around and I could see everybody was having something better than me. You know? So anyway, that's got us about 4 more minutes. So I think I am gonna wrap up. I will just say, I am truly grateful for this program. And a million times I would have sold myself short. And like a million times, God brought me back here and the people of AA opened their arms. And I know I hope to carry that forward. I know I hope to do that at West Ghent. I know I hope to do that at AA 101. Even though that's the hardest meeting to find if you ever want to go there. They have like guides to take you through. But thank you so much for having me out here, and I'm so grateful to be sober and a part of this fellowship.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Sarah, for coming out. It is the first month of the year, so I've asked Jake to come up and talk about step one for a little bit. We've got a little bit of time.
Sarah, thank you for sharing. When we have a little bit of time at the end of the meeting, we do talk about the step of the month. And we are still in January. Yep, so that's good. Happy New Year to everybody. So I came to believe that that I was powerless against alcohol, and that my life had become unmanageable. And all of the things that I suffered through brought me to that convincing point. I had to be convinced of those two things. And they had to be, it couldn't be one without the other in order to find success that I have found in AA. And success is, you know, runs the gambit of whatever that word might be to you. But in order for me to get, to come in here, I had to go through quite a bit, and some of it was early on in my drinking that I didn't recognize at first that was a form of suffering. But I was so young that I felt like I could just bounce off of whatever obstacles were coming my way that alcohol caused. You know, I had gotten a DUI in the military. It cost me some money and some rank, and set me back to zero. When it came to the rank status in the military, it brought shame to my family. You know, my dad, you know, my parents came to see a dog and pony show that we were doing at a graduation that I was part of. And after the dog and pony show, he walked up and I was missing two stripes. And he's like, and he had been in the military, he knew all about that. He's like, where's your stripes at? And I had to tell him I had gotten a DUI. And so, that didn't faze me. I was still more interested. I was less interested in his disappointing looks, and I was more interested in what was going to be happening that night, which is a big kegger that we were preparing for, you know, keg party, and we're going to celebrate the accomplishments that we had all made that I barely got a chance to finish, to complete. So I could go through a litany of stories of pain and suffering, but when it came down to the reason why I came in here, I had come to the end of the road. I thought I had no hope other than what I had already known about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had actually hit a rock bottom twice. First time got me at the VA center as an inpatient for 4 months, and I did what I could do to stay sober for about 2 years. And then decided I was going to pull away from the meetings. I was going to fire my sponsor, fire everybody, and I didn't need it, you know, that I could rely on my own willpower and that I would never drink again. I had every intention of not drinking again. Within a year, I was drinking again. Went through another 3 or 4 months, more pain and suffering, and then came back in. So I knew that I had no hope other than to do better what I tried to do before, which was come back in here with my tail tucked between my legs, and you know, it was that new day was when I went back in. I suffered through another 2 years of trying to manage my life in AA. I had a sponsor. We didn't really talk to each other. We would run into each other in meetings. And there was no formal, his version of sponsorship was, well, where were we in the book last time we talked? I don't worry about it, we'll start here. And it wasn't even at the beginning, you know. Yeah, but what he did for me was he sponsored me. his way, the way that he was sponsored. And I was willing to do what was working for him. Until it got to a point where it wasn't working for me. Yeah. And it took 2 years to come to that conclusion. Because my life in AA had become unmanageable once again. So I was suffering from now untreated alcoholism. Right? I wasn't drinking, but I was suffering through untreated alcoholism. The treatment that I had been doing had run its course. I don't know about you, but if I used to, you know, do other substances, and I would come to the point where my body would just it would lose the effect, and so I'd have to up the dosage. Right, so I had to up the dosage of AA. I had to find a sponsor that was going to give me more to do. And then we started in the big book. And then my life's unmanageability started to change. You know, the things that looked good on paper, you know, I had, in those 2 years, I had gone to school, gotten another career that I liked, gotten married, had a kid, and yet my life was still unmanageable. I looked good on paper, but I was going downhill and I was on the verge of drinking again. So I had, at that point, half of step one in the bag, because I knew I was powerless against alcohol, but I still had to get convinced more that my life was still, you know, was unmanageable. I had to come to that conclusion once again. And then, like, I don't know about you, when you think of a new car that you want to get, and you start liking this new car, you never saw it on the road before, but now that you think about this new car that you really want, you see that car on the road all the time. I started to think, I need a new sponsor. So I really started seeing the people that I was gravitating towards. I was attracted to what people were saying at that point, because I was listening for it in meetings. And I found a guy. And that guy said something in the meeting. I don't even remember what he said, but I was attracted to what he said because it sounded like he knew exactly what to do, you know? And I think that that's how we find our sponsors, is that we find somebody that knows exactly what to do, can tell me precisely what I need to do, because my life was unmanageable. And that person, after that meeting was over, I had the intention of walking up to that individual. I'd never done that before. I was always trying to just get out of the meeting, right? You know, so I gotta go home. I went to the meeting. Now I don't want to go home. But after this meeting, I wanted to talk to that individual. Well, I didn't have to make the initiation. That individual walked up to me with his name and number on a post-it, and he spotted me. Probably spotted me as soon as I walked in, right? I didn't even say anything in the meeting. How would this guy know to come up and talk to me? And introduce himself in that way. But he said something to the effect, if you want help with whatever's going on in your life, give me a call, we'll talk about it. So I did. I called him, and I got involved. And I've known as for a very long time, his reluctant sponsee, because even though I knew my life was unmanageable, I was still reluctant at every step of the way. I questioned everything. I tried to bait him in debates, tried to bait him in arguments. And from the beginning, he said, though, that this stuff is non-negotiable. You're either going to do it or not. Because guess what? My life's manageable. I'm doing what I'm doing, and my life's pretty good, you know? So if you want what I have, you got to do what I do. If you want to be able to have manageability in your life, then you got to do what I do. So that's what I try and do today. I tried to make my cake the way that you guys make your cake, the cakes that look good, you know. It's been a long road, but I started implementing these things in my life, in my work life, in my family life. The hardest part was to implement it in my family life. It was hard to admit, and really what I've been doing now is admitting to my wife that sometimes I am unmanageable, you know. And I freely admit it to her, and she can respect that, you know. I don't look at it as me lying down and being a lap dog, but I look at it as me humbling myself enough to admit to people, to admit to you guys, to admit to people that are in my life that I don't always have it together. But that's okay, because I can admit to you that I don't. And so with that, I'll end, and I appreciate you guys coming out all the way out to Suffolk. Thank you.